Hello, I'm Katie Piper, and welcome to my podcast, Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. Each episode, I'll meet an amazing person with an incredible story who faced adversity and came through the other side to inspire others. Today, I'm talking to Jack Ayres. After a debilitating condition in his leg left Jack in pain, even just walking, he chose at the age of 16 to have his leg amputated. He's since gone on to become the first ever amputee Mr. England and is also a personal trainer, a GB paracanoe athlete, a charity ambassador and catwalk model. He tells me how he turned his life around after his surgery, away from drugs and alcohol, and how another amputee inspired him to go ahead with the surgery and achieve his dreams. Jack, thanks for coming on to talk to me today.
Thank you very much.
Tell me a little bit about yourself.
I'm currently 29, mm-hmm. and I'm living in East Midlands.
Right.
I'm a British canoe athlete. I've been invited onto the programme October last year. July last year, I actually won the title of Mr. England, and I'm also a personal trainer as well.
Wow, okay. So you have a very busy diary.
I do have a busy diary, yeah.
So with the being an athlete, what led you to this sport, to the canoeing?
So I was based in Bournemouth for around 6 years, and I had a strong client base in Bournemouth, working with clients both able-bodied and less so.
So this is with the personal training?
With the personal training, okay. Yeah. And just for general fitness, just because I really enjoy being outside, I love being on the water. So I used to do a lot of water skiing, I used to do a lot of open water swimming in the sea, but I also used to do a bit of kayaking and canoeing. And my local club, Poole Harbour Canoe Club, received an email, and it was from British Canoeing, and they were looking for new talent for a brand new discipline called the VAR. And this was looking for talent for Tokyo 2020.
Right.
And they invited me to Nottingham, which is where their sort of headquarters is based. And they put me on a 5-day trial.
My goodness.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, you're a PT, so you're physically fit at this point, but you're not an athlete at this point, right?
No, but I'd like to say that I've always trained like an athlete.
Okay.
So I really enjoy training hard. And actually, I use it as pain relief. So for me, actually being in the gym is my way of building self-confidence and also pain relief as well. And it always has been.
And for those listening who don't know your background, why was confidence an issue for you when you were younger?
So I was actually born with a condition in my right leg, and the condition was called PFFD,
right.
Or proximal femoral focal deficiency, and it's a birth defect, basically. So, yeah, so I was born with this condition in my leg. It got progressively worse and worse through childhood. It affected my femur and my hip joint.
Right. So were you in a lot of pain as a child?
Yeah. It affected the muscles around the femur and the hip joint as well. So it became very underdeveloped, which meant that I was... underdeveloped on one side, so it put a lot of pressure on my back, which put a lot of pressure on my hips, which put a lot of pressure on my walking as well. So, yeah, it became quite a lot of discomfort. Ended up having various operations to have my hip rebuilt. And
so did you miss out on a lot of education in school if you were in hospital?
Yeah, I did miss on quite a lot more than I would have wanted to. It's weird. It's kind of a foggy memory for me, really. It almost felt normal. Like, I didn't really realise that I was, I'm wiggling my fingers here, disabled until...
Do you use that word or are you anti that word?
Do you know what? I've got this label around my neck of being disabled, and people understand the word disabled. And it's a way of making people understand where I'm coming from. But I hate the word disabled. Well, handicapped, disabled, I don't use it.
How would you describe or define yourself?
I'm an amputee.
Right.
I've got one leg. I'm an amputee. There's nothing I can't do. I can run, I can lunge, I can squat, I can do anything. Like...
Yeah.
I'm not disabled. It doesn't restrict me. I'm not unable, so I'm not disabled.
Yeah. And you're sat in front of me now. You're a confident 29-year-old man, and like you said, extremely able. But what was the young Jack like? I mean, you talked about school. I mean, it's a really hard time whether you're able or disabled.
It is a hard time. And, like, it's a really fragile period of someone growing up, you know? And I think that... I was very lost. You know, I really, really wanted to relate to somebody.
Right.
I really wanted to kind of learn from somebody. But I live in a small town called Wells, which is near Glastonbury in Somerset. I was the only disabled kid in the school.
That's tough.
I was very singled out. I was very alone, or how I felt anyway. I was very alone. You know, I had to, you know, find my own way of doing things. I was always into sport. So I was always playing football. I played football for school, played rugby, played cricket. I used to swim for county. I used to horse ride. I used to do loads and loads of stuff.
How did you do all that when you had the medical condition with your leg, though? Surely if you were in extreme pain, how did you... was it just mental? What do you think it was? That mental strength?
Because my friends were doing it.
Right.
And like I said, I didn't really realise I was disabled until it started looking at careers. Mm-hmm. I didn't realise that nobody else was in pain. I thought it was normal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was just as fast as everybody else. It got progressively worse, my condition.
Mm.
So, you know, my early school years, I was running around and I was just like everyone else. I had a bit of like a knee brace and stuff to support my leg.
But did physical activity make it worse?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it would inflame and... Mm. Right, okay.
Yeah, and I, like I said, I had my hip rebuilt a number of times because my hip is very fragile.
Mm-hmm.
I've been into plaster from my armpits down to my ankles.
Mm. I mean, this podcast is about choices and it's a funny word to attribute to you because it kind of reminds me of that quote of, well, you never know how strong you are until being strong is the only choice you have.
Yeah.
So some could say you got to a certain stage in your life where you had a choice to amputate your leg. Was it a choice? Do you feel you were faced with a choice, or was that the only option really left to you? I mean, you were 16 then, right?
I was 16, yeah. It was completely my choice. It was elective surgery. So basically what was happening was through my younger years of school, my condition got worse and I became a lot more pain, and they started talking about career. And I got into a bit of a downward spiral because of this career. I was kind of like, just realised that I was disabled, can't be in the military, can't do all the things that my friends want to do.
Is that what you wanted to do, a military career?
I was a bit naive too. I didn't really know what the military was, but
yeah.
I'm a practical guy, I'm a physical guy, and I really fancied this, you know, adventure lifestyle. And it wasn't until the teachers kind of said to me, let's think about other things. What do you want to do?
Yeah.
And it kind of really hit home.
What options were offered to you then? What sort of things did they say would suit Jack?
And this is what I got really annoyed about. The teachers would always say, what do you want to do when you grow up? Well, you tell me. You're the teacher.
Yeah.
You teach me. And this is what I was craving. I was craving someone to tell me what to do. Inspiration, exactly.
Did you have any role models growing up?
So then I got into this really dark place and I ended up going to the prosthetic centre, the limb centre, and I was having some work done. And my mom had mentioned to my prosthetist that I was, you know, really struggling. Is there anyone that I can speak to? And
so this is after having the surgery?
No, this is before my amputation.
Before your amputation, right.
I was about 12 years old.
Okay.
And they said, well, by chance, there is a guy next door. His name's Louis Brownsell. He's a larger-than-life character, big, big character. You want to chat to him.
So he's a patient, isn't he?
He was a patient, right. Yeah. Started talking to this guy. Well, mom did most of the talking at the time. He was born exactly the same as me, with a very similar condition.
Oh, that's rare to meet someone
like
that.
I know, yeah, exactly, yeah. And again, this first time I'd ever met someone who was in my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Had his leg amputated when he was 16, and he now called himself a one-legged stuntman.
Right.
He'd just been filming Saving Private Ryan with Steven Spielberg,
blown
up on the beach. He showed me all these photos. He was the figure of the mummy. He was the outline of the mummy. Camera phones weren't around back then, so he got his wallet out, he showed me about six different girls he was dating. He just blew my mind in terms of inspiration. He'd just been over to America, filmed with Leonardo DiCaprio. He was living the lifestyle.
A celebrity lifestyle.
Absolutely. And that was what was, you know, I really aspired to be like that, and that was purely my focus. From the age of 12, I said, I want my leg amputated, I want to be like Louis, I want to be a one-legged stuntman.
Wow.
Which, of course, I'm making my mum and my family listen to me say, I want my leg cut off.
Yeah,
they were like,
quite hard to hear that, isn't it?
And
Are you spiritual? Do you believe you were supposed to meet that guy that day?
Yeah, no, I am spiritual. Definitely very spiritual. I believe that really set my life.
Mm.
You know, one of the first things that I did, I had my leg amputated at 16. By the age of 18, I joined an agency and I was being blown up on sets, ripped apart by werewolves and vampires. So
you don't mess around. My God.
Yeah.
So to get to this surgery, did you have to convince your parents? Because when you consent, don't you have to be 18 to consent?
Yeah.
So you'd have to get your mum and dad's permission.
Yeah. So they originally said that I wasn't allowed to amputate until I was 18.
Yeah.
And this was to get the measurements right of my leg, because you can't cut the stump too long or
You're
too short.
Still growing as well.
So I was still growing.
Yeah.
So they wanted to get the measurements right. But it got to the point where I was so down about life, lost and whatever, I was like, if you don't cut it off, I will.
Yeah.
I convinced them to amputate,
mm-hmm.
Age of 16. And it was the best thing
that
could have happened.
It's a massive physical recovery to go through the age of 16. Like the amount of physio and rehabilitation you must have had to
I mean, that blows my mind. I mean, I obviously a completely different, my story's not, there's no parallels in the physical of our stories.
Yeah.
But, you know, I know what it's like to go through extensive rehabilitation in my early 20s, and it was frustrating.
Yeah.
So at 16, I can't imagine how hard it must have been to see friends. Well, what do people do at 16? They meet girls, they get drunk, they go out, and you're like in this huge medical journey.
Yeah. I think I grew up pretty quick because of it. I was, again, very naive of what the amputation meant. You know, there's pictures of me just about to go into the hospital bed and I've got my thumbs up, smiling at the camera. I was in a very immature frame of mind, actually. And I discharged myself from after 5 days of having my leg amputated.
I've done things like that. Yeah.
And I caught septicemia and MRSA.
Wow.
And I went back in for 2 more weeks. Mm-hmm. And yeah, stuff like that. So, you know, it was a massive learning curve.
Mm-hmm. But that's being young and being impatient. And that's understandable, isn't it? Like, you just want to close one chapter and open the door to another one.
Yeah.
So when after you had this amputation, it was a long road. For people who don't understand the medical reasons behind this, what did you think you would gain and lose by doing the amputation? What was your motive? I mean, we know you met this guy, he inspired you.
Yeah.
But your leg was physically holding you back.
Yeah, my leg was physically holding me back. And it was very deformed in terms of like underdeveloped around the muscle.
Right.
The knee joint didn't work properly and my hip joint still doesn't work very well. But Louis, this guy who inspired me, had his leg amputated and he was now walking around with a metal leg with a knee and he could sit there with 2 bent legs, which I couldn't do.
Wow. Okay.
So things for me like getting on public transport, I couldn't do. My leg was out straight. I couldn't go on roller coasters. I couldn't go to the cinema because my leg was out straight.
Mm-hmm.
There was lots of things that was really restricted, even going on like flights and like, going on planes. And
no Ryanair.
No, exactly. Because, you know, I'm 6'2" and I have been for a long time and having a straight leg was very, very impractical. So the thing for me, again, I keep using this word crave, but I was craving being normal.
I mean, that's the ironic thing about your story, right? So you went and, like you said, electively had your leg removed and became an amputee. But from the way you're talking, it sounds like before this removal, in the period in your life prior, you felt depressed, down and identified as disabled. And then now what society says is disabled by removing your leg, you broke free of that label and now you don't identify as disabled.
Absolutely.
So this is actually like this whole interview isn't really about the physical body. This is a lot about the mind, is it?
Yeah, it really is. The thing is, I've always had it within me. I've always had a fire in my belly to be better than someone.
Mm-hmm.
And in my own way,
that's the PT in you.
Yeah, exactly.
Competitive bunch, you PT.
It is. But even when I was a child, I found my own way of trying to be better than the next person. I was always trying to fight for being better.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really hard, you know, when I was, you know, I'm not the sort of person to want to sit still for too long because I get very uncomfortable. I'm not the sort of person, you know, I lost this ability to be fast on my feet because my leg was getting worse. So where'd you go from
you
there?
You did sit still, from what, 12 to 16 was a period where you did sit still, right?
Yeah.
What was that period like?
It was tough. It was really tough. You know, I used drugs and alcohol as a mask.
And did you develop an addiction, like a dependency?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was smoking weed every single day. I was smoking, drinking. I was doing class A's, class B's at the weekends, sometimes weekdays as well. I think because, you know, apart from Louis being my role model, my other role models were people like Tupac, Eminem. Like that was the sort of music I was listening to and that's the way I dressed and you know, all the rest of it. So, you know, drugs was part of their music. So for me to be doing drugs, smoking or whatever, I thought I was making this hard image.
So were you fitting in? Was that like an element?
I was fitting in,
You know, I've had problems myself in my recovery with using alcohol as an outlet for pain and for confidence. And actually, when you're on any kind of rehabilitation or treatment, drugs and alcohol obviously damage the body even further.
Yeah.
And you're already fighting damage as it is. So that must have hindered your medical condition.
It did. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I discharged myself from hospital after 5 days having my leg amputated. I got caught smoking a spliff out the hospital window.
Right. Okay.
So they were kind of like, I fell out with the nurses and I was told to go home. Yeah, I went home and instead of healing, I was still in the garage smoking dope. And that's
why, you know, you're thinning the blood, like you're doing also. I mean, as a PT, I guess you know all that now.
Yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, how do you go from being, like, this may sound crude, but like a drug addict to an athlete and Mr. England?
Yeah.
Like, that's a big transition.
Yeah. I think, so I was then rushed back into hospital with suspected MRSA and septicemia. Mm-hmm. I spent 2 weeks in hospital. I actually spent New Year's Eve in hospital.
Wow.
16 years old. I told, you know, my family, my mum and that to go home. I spent New Year's Eve on my own in hospital with a raging infection.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, I had like an epiphany. It just dawned on me. I just started drawing. And I was really into artwork at the time. I was studying art and design at college. And I just drew me in a hospital bed with, you know, surgeons like cutting into me. And I, for some reason, just started to think about what can I do? What can I do that's going to be amazing? And I wanted to be a firefighter. My stepdad at the time was a firefighter.
Okay.
And I wanted to be a firefighter. Did my research, found out there was two guys who were currently serving as an amputee.
Mm-hmm.
They were below the knee. So I'd be the first above knee amputee to make it in.
Right.
Spent the next 3 years of my life.
That probably motivated you to know you'd be the first.
Well, this is it. Yeah. And it really did. It really did. And as soon as I left hospital, you know, I stopped smoking, stopped drinking, joined the gym. And that was my turning point.
So is this where the journey of becoming a PT started when you joined a gym then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. So I really focused on becoming a firefighter.
Mm-hmm.
I did a little bit of youth work on the side as well.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the youth work that we were doing, we were teaching 12 to 18 year olds about health and fitness. And I ended up going on an active course so mm-hmm. that I could teach them.
Right.
And it just sparked my excitement for teaching fitness.
And were there ever people around you, maybe of, I don't know, an older generation or whatever generation, raising the eyebrows like, well, he can't be a PT. Mm-hmm. People won't take fitness advice of him.
Yeah, I'm sure. Do you know what? Like, I have wiggled my fingers again, disabled my whole life. You know, I'm pretty numb to rejection.
Mm-hmm.
I've especially got to the point now in my life where I am just numb to rejection.
But that's an interesting concept, because some people who face constant rejection, give up, but your rejection for you, you've just become immune.
Yeah, but I'm very confident in my ability now,
mm-hmm.
so I know what I can achieve.
So when you became a PT, did you have insecurities or reservations about, will I get any clients? Will I be able to make a living off this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was soon proved wrong. So as soon as I became a personal trainer, I had clients coming to me so quick. You know, people thought I was ex-military.
That's what
really brought them in. People were just interested to talk to me.
You could just make up a lie that you got blown up or something.
Like just eaten by a shark or whatever it is, yeah. But so, you know, I was attracting people. People were interested in my story. People were interested in my training technique. And because I'm, you know, I train myself really hard, I've always trained like an athlete. You know, the amount of times I get somebody come up to me, I've really hurt my knee, but I've just seen you doing squats 140. How would you do that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm like, okay, I'll show you.
Yeah.
Pay me some money.
Yeah. So actually, it's been an icebreaker in that way, has it? An intro to to get clients.
Yeah.
Do you still work as a PT now?
I do a bit of online training, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you specialise then? Do you help other amputees? Has that been like a niche thing?
Without actually pushing it as that. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. You know, I've had amputees from all over the world contacting me and asking me questions about training and just very interested in my story and how I've got to where I am. And, you know, before I was very self-conscious about my body. I used to wear 2 pairs of trousers to try and hide my leg.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since 2012, when I joined this modelling campaign, I'm now happy to stand in my boxes and to show off my body. And people were actually asking me how to get a body like mine, which is a massive like circle. It's a big spin.
Yeah,
you know,
it is.
Complete contrast of what it was before.
But not just for you, but within society. Like for people to look at somebody that, say, 10 years ago, we would have, you know, I remember being at school and the only experience I had of an amputee, it was the people we have to raise money for in our school group.
Yeah.
And that was it. Like they were, I don't think we even had Paralympians at school.
No.
So, you know, and they weren't seen as anything other than somebody we should have empathy and understanding for.
Yeah.
So for people to aspire to look like you and you to be their body goals, I mean, that's actually quite a big social movement, isn't it?
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah, it was really huge. And I think, you know, 2012 Paralympics really moved that. They really helped with that shift, you know, calling them superhumans. And, you know, that really helped. And also the injured servicemen coming back from, you know, war or whatever and doing amazing things like walking across Antarctica or whatever it was, you know, doing amazing things. They've really changed that perception of disability. For me at school, when I looked at somebody with a disability, you know, they were villains.
Mm-hmm.
They were like James Bond villains. They were Captain Hooks missing an arm. They were, you know, it was somebody you didn't want to be like.
Yeah.
It was somebody who was freaky and ugly and, you know, was in the naughty corner.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's why what we believe is beautiful is it's why we're conditioned to believe only certain ideals are beautiful.
Yeah.
Or even, like you said, you know, certain bodies are only able of achieving physical greatness.
Yeah.
What I find interesting about you is you hold this title. You're the current Mr. England, but you're not Mr. Disabled England. Your peers and your competitors are able-bodied men.
Yeah.
So you weren't the most inspiring guy with no leg.
No.
So, I mean, that's quite a big thing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I will deliberately try and avoid any situation where it is just disabled people in a situation like that, apart from, obviously, the Olympics, the Paralympic stuff that I'm doing now, which is, you know, slightly different.
Yeah.
But, yeah, in the past, I've always try to avoid any situations like that.
Because actually it's not really celebrating what you're about, is it? And it's still putting you, you know, in that pigeonhole. And, you know, I mean, I'll find sometimes if people write articles about me, they'll kind of label me like, I don't know, like inspiring burnt girl. And you're like, what even is that? Like, how is that helping anything? And, you know, one small part of me is that I got burnt, but there's loads of other parts to me. And, and sometimes, you know, trying to shake off, like, do you want to be people's inspiration?
I've set a goal to become a role model because that's what changed my life. Louis changed my life forever. Mm. He was a role model to me.
Yeah.
The fact that he had one leg is because I connected with him. So if I, you know, there's other guys out there with one leg. There's other people who are suffering. So if I can connect with somebody and become a role model, then being Mr. Inspiration, it's a bit.
Yeah.
No, I'm not really in. It's a grey line, though, isn't it? It's
tough.
This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Frame. Mother's Day is almost here. What are you getting her? Something that shows you care. Something that makes her feel loved. Something that won't stress you out. Something like the Skylight Frame. The Skylight Frame is the perfect gift. It's a touchscreen photo frame your whole family can upload photos to, from wherever they are in the world. It's a way to share with her all the moments that matter. It sets up in seconds. You can even make sure that it's already loaded with photos when your mom opens her Mother's Day gift. And her Skylight Frame can hold thousands of the treasured photos you share. It's an easy, heartfelt way for mom to stay connected with those who matter most. It really is the perfect gift. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightframe.com/easy.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Jack, in part one, we were talking about how you faced adversity and how you overcame that. And actually, through a condition you were born with, you chose to have your leg amputated.
Yeah.
And then now I'm introducing you as Mr. England.
Yeah.
Tell me how we got from A to B and where is C? How does one become Mr. England?
Sure. I think the biggest thing for me is I took control of my life. And that was the thing that I always wanted to do. Took control of my life. I had elective surgery, had my leg amputated. I didn't really know where it was going to lead to, but the biggest thing for me, I wanted to join this agency and I wanted to be a one-legged stuntman.
Mm-hmm.
Through this agency work, I was then invited to take part in the 2012 Paralympic opening ceremony.
Right.
I trained with a circus.
I took part in that.
Did you?
Yeah.
The opening ceremony?
Yeah.
Ah, what did you do?
I was a torch carrier.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah,
oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Cool. We were climbing ropes. We were tumbling down in the middle.
Of course you were.
Yeah.
with one leg. Of course you were. Expect no less. Yeah.
So I spent 4 months training with a circus school in London.
Right.
And they taught us how to fly around in harnesses, sort of 30 metres in the air, how to climb 10-foot ropes and tumble down doing cabaret-style performances.
And was this one of the first times that people had said, you can do this?
Yeah.
Like, this is totally open to you?
Yeah.
Like,
so there was a selection process, and it started off with, I don't know, 80 people going through, all with different disabilities, and it got whittled down to about 40. And I made the selection process because of my determination and my physical ability, I guess.
How did that feel?
It was great. It was amazing. And the money was fantastic. And
always helps.
I was getting out of, you know, where I've always wanted to live in London, and it allowed me to live in London for 4 months and experience that sort of thing. So mm-hmm. it was a huge experience. It was amazing. And then, of course, you perform this daring cabaret style performance in front of 80,000 people and the royal family, and it's on TV.
No pressure.
No, exactly, yeah. But it was my first taste of the limelight.
Right, okay.
And it was incredible. The whole story behind it of using disabled people was to break the barrier of disability, being yeah. weak and vulnerable.
In such an unconventional way, you yeah. know, and it doesn't feel like a tick box tokenism yeah. thing. So did that inspire you then to say, I want a piece of this and I can do this?
Yeah. So I really wanted a little bit more of the limelight. So mm-hmm. I kind of looked for the next thing. I came across an advert in a magazine. And the advert was for a campaign called Models of Diversity. Mm-hmm. And they were looking for more models in mm-hmm. Diverse models in the fashion industry. And I was a personal trainer at the time, and I thought, let's try a bit of fitness modelling. Mm-hmm. I went and met Angel St. Clair, who's the founder. She gave me some tips and some workshops on right. how to use my body and use the work with the lighting so that the camera could take some really good pictures.
Okay.
And it kind of all went from there, really. But, I mean, after being involved with Models Diversity, I was then pushed into more fashion.
And okay.
ended up being the first amputee to walk at New York Fashion Week.
Really?
I then went to Milan Fashion Week. Wow. I went to Moscow Fashion Week and then walked to London Fashion Week.
Yeah.
And then I was then given a talk in the NEC Clothes Show in Birmingham.
Right.
On body confidence.
Yeah.
And that's when I was talent spotted for the Mr. England.
Right.
So they approached me.
Oh, this just gets better. Like, he didn't enter, guys. He got headhunted.
So, you know,
that's good for your confidence.
Exactly, yeah. So I went in there knowing that I ticked a few boxes.
Yeah.
So the things you need to do, you need to submit a talent. So yeah. for me, it was water skiing. You submit it on YouTube, and it's mm-hmm. all based on views and likes.
Right, okay.
And then you have to do social media, where people have to like and share mm-hmm. A picture. And then you have to do public vote, where people have to ring in or text in. It's mm-hmm. all to do with the public. And I won that round.
Wow. Were you the only person who entered with a disability?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I am. I still am. I'm the right. only person who's kind of entered.
Ever?
I think so. Yeah, as wow. far as I'm aware. Definitely amputee. I don't know about disability.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, you have to do general knowledge. Then you have to do fitness testing. Then there's the topless catwalk. And then there's sportswear. And then there's tux. And there's questions and answers on stage in front of a live audience. There's charity. You have to raise a certain amount of money for charity. So there's lots and lots of boxes. Mm-hmm. And I managed to do pretty well. I worked really hard for 3 months on the lead up to the finals of Mr. England.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever at any stage feel inadequate or less of a contestant compared to anyone else? Did you ever get those feelings creeping in?
The only feelings I had sort of creeping in were I didn't want to win this just because of my leg.
Right.
And
then the whole thing would be pointless.
Exactly, yeah. yeah. I had TV cameras following me around, and one of the interviews we had was, they said, how's it going to feel when you win the title? And I'm right. like, what do you mean when I win? I haven't won it yet. And they were like, I can't remember exactly what they said, but they hinted towards my leg. You know, said, you're very inspirational because of your leg.
Mm.
I was just like, I don't want to win this because
did
of my leg.
Did that annoy you?
It did really annoy
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
And they said it in front of the other contestants as well.
Yeah.
And like, them and my mates, you know, they're all yeah. like the guys that I've been bonding with the last 3 days,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to hear that it really kind of took it away.
Yeah. Because you should win on all your merits and credits,
yeah.
not on a sympathy
yeah.
act.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. 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 So yeah, that did annoy me a little bit.
But you did win and you won for the right reasons.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And now you're planning world domination, I hear. yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. So January next year is Mr. World. It's over in Manila in the Philippines.
Right.
I'm the only amputee that's going.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's gonna be amazing. It's gonna be.
And you're confident?
Yeah, I'm confident. Yeah, yeah.
You're
yeah,
anything?
Yeah.
Well, I don't expect anything less from you. You're always confident. It's funny because I always get asked to judge these competitions, like the regional heats
yeah.
and Miss Great Britain, and I always say no because I always wrongly think it's about judging women's worth on yeah. their appearance, but yeah. actually. Now listening to you, I guess
things
actually
changed.
It's changed. It's
yeah.
moved on.
Yeah.
Like pageants, as we know them, yeah. aren't actually that anymore. Then
no. I mean, technically, I've won a beauty pageant.
Yeah, technically, yeah.
But it's kind of not really. You're not really allowed to call it pageants anymore. It's
right.
more of a competition around the modern man.
Yeah. yeah. So this is a really nice final thought. Do you represent the modern man?
I'd like to think I do. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've got, you know. Because of my personal training background as well, you know, people come to me asking me for advice on how to better their way of life. So that is, you know, that's becoming a role model. And I believe the modern man should always have that sort of air about them. People should always kind of like want to be like them and look up to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the younger you, maybe the message would have been reinforced that you'll never be the modern man.
No.
Because this is a permanent thing.
Yeah.
And you've got to learn to adapt and live in possibly whatever life you can, you know, a mediocre, just about getting through.
Yeah.
Don't aspire beyond this and just accept as some kind of safety net.
Yeah.
I mean, what would you say to people listening? You don't have to be an amputee to be listening and getting something from this.
No.
Anybody that may be mentally where you were at or physically where you were at when you're younger, what advice would you give to those people?
Take control of your life. Like you don't have to just follow it day by day. Like take control, actually set a goal, get some inspiration. The hardest thing is to try and find inspiration. Like if you're in a really dark, down place, what do you want to do? It's really hard to find that. What do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
But that's the most important thing. Be realistic. You know, it's good to surround yourself with great people because great things happen. So I don't mean going to the pub and trying to look for someone there.
Yeah.
Go to the gym and actually surround yourself with someone you want to be like. Or go and start a sport in, you know, your local sports club or whatever. Or, you know, there's lots of different ways. Whatever inspires you, that's only things that would inspire me.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be gym or sport. It could be down the local theatre or whatever it might be, you know.
Whatever gets you going,
exactly.
Your interests.
Yeah. But it's about really honing in on what makes you tick.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that from the start, I think.
Mm-hmm.
What really inspired me.
But you had to just channel it and you had to, like you said, tune into it.
Yeah.
We've had an email in from a young man called Michael. And actually, he's got a firefighter background like you. He said, I'll try to keep it brief. I worked as a firefighter for 11 years and I attended many different incidents, but one caused me major problems. After months, I was diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I ended up a virtual recluse and I gained over 40 kilos in weight and I suffered panic attacks, rage and flashbacks. After different medication and counselling, I was referred to a programme aimed at overweight men. I completed the course and my confidence has started to return and I lost some weight. I started volunteering with them for the last 18 months and have helped at 3 meetings a week. I've now made great progress in my mental health as well as losing over 30 kg. Wow. I mean, that's something we've sort of touched on. You've talked about mental health.
Yeah.
And obviously this guy's journey with the PTSD, that is, you know, being locked in within the mind.
Yeah.
Have you found being a man? I mean, I obviously sit opposite you. I had PTSD on my journey.
Yeah.
And I think as women, we're quite encouraged to talk about the mental health side of things. What's it been like for you as a man?
I think I used to tend to avoid. If I ever found myself in an uncomfortable situation or I've had uncomfortable thoughts, I used to avoid the thoughts, which actually doesn't help at all. It's about tackling those thoughts as soon as they come about. And you can ask for help for that. There's a lot of awareness nowadays in the media and there's a lot of stuff going on out there that can really help you focus on what it is that's making you feel uncomfortable, that's making you feel, and you can work on that.
Do you think it's important? I mean, you've come here today and you've been very open in talking not just about your successes, but also when you did rely on unhealthy things and when things were bad. I mean, it's about being honest, isn't it? About your journey.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about being honest. You know, this guy, he's a firefighter. He wants to help. He wants to do amazing things. Mm. It's really good that he started to volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And before you read out about the volunteer, I was almost going to say, he needs to volunteer at this place because he wants to help people.
Yeah.
So that's fantastic, you know, and that was really going to help him.
Is that what do you do quite a lot of charity stuff yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think charity work is really important.
Because there's a quote, which I'm not going to get right now, but there is a quote I saw the other day on Instagram about happiness is actually about what you give to others. Because really, you say the word charity, there's no act, there's no selfless act, because when you go and enable and help somebody else, you do get a feeling of satisfaction.
Yeah.
And you know, we started this interview with you warning me that you might swear if you get if you get passionate.
Yeah.
But when you do have something you become passionate about, you actually get joy from it and you actually get fulfillment from it. And most people's passions lie within helping others.
Absolutely.
Really.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things that in nowadays society, if you want to give your time to somebody, you expect to be paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's become a bit foggy. You know, I think if you want to do something,
yeah,
regardless, you're going to get paid, as long as you get some enjoyment from it, or as long as you get an experience from it, or as long as somebody else gets some experience from it or enjoyment from it, then you need to go ahead and do it. Stop worrying about the money. Like, the money will come.
Yeah, that will follow.
Yeah.
I mean, you've talked a lot about many defining moments on your journey. Is there one piece of advice that has stayed with you that somebody's given you?
I really like this quote, surround yourself with great people and great things happen.
Yeah, I love that.
But my favourite all-time quote is, life begins outside of your comfort zone, so learn to embrace it and get used to it.
That's so good. That's a great one for the gym, when you just want to give up on those sets.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Oh, that's excellent. You know what? You've really motivated me. I was supposed to go running this morning and I hit snooze. So I think I might go running after this podcast. But thank you for sharing, not, like I said, not just the highs, but also the lows, because I think that's really important.
Yeah.
And I look forward to getting you back in the seat when you're Mr. World.
Yeah. Thank you, Katie. Thank you.
Good luck. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for listening to Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. If you haven't already, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, I'm talking to Denise Fergus, the mother of James Bulger. We talk about her fight for justice for James, her campaigning and charity work, and she will make sure James will never be forgotten. If you enjoyed this, please help us spread the word. Rate and review the show where you got this, or share on socials.